So much fun in that book, Strange Stars, Jason Heller, including great details about that particular track from David Bowie. It's really one of the first that, along with Space Oddity, but from that Ziggy Stardust album that really broke him. Space Oddity was kind of a slow starter. It didn't really catch on in the United States until years later. But after Ziggy Stardust, they brought back Space Oddity, and that really, that's when it became firmly planted in the pop culture mindset of the early 1970s. But, you know, you don't have to talk about music when we go to open lines. You don't have to talk about science fiction. You can. I certainly encourage you, if you've been hanging on for it, to get to your point or question if you want to. But take us anywhere else you want to go. Your open line calls for the rest of the night. Coming up next on Coast to Coast, in for George Norrie, this is Ian Punnett. I'll try to get to these in the order that they've been hanging on the longest for. Let me go to Peter in Miami. Open lines on Coast to Coast AM. Peter?
Hello, Ian. How are you?
I had a lot of fun with our first our guest for the first half of the show, so I'm cruising.
Yes, sir. I really wanted to ask him about Jethro Tull and Aqualung.
Well, that's interesting you should bring up Aqualung, because, I mean, I think of Aqualung as much more of an album about religion than about space. But the band, you know, is very ethereal in many ways, but I think that's where I am with Aqualung. I love Aqualung. I hate it when they edit Locomotive Breath on radio. It just drives me crazy. I'm pretty big on that album. Why were you making that connection to the conversation about the explosion of science fiction?
Well, and then along, because I'm a Vietnam veteran.
Right.
I listened to Jimi Hendrix.
Yeah.
And especially when he put the guitar pick between his teeth and played the guitar.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, I think the cool thing, I mean, Aqualung was, what, 71 or something? Were you in Nam in 71, or were you home by then?
No, I was still in Vietnam.
Wow. Well, thank you for your service, as always.
No charge. Aqualung's,
yeah. Aqualung is a great album. You know, there's a word for this. It's it kind of reminds me actually of Odyssey, Space Odyssey, but the word is theodicy, and it's a word that means figuring out where God is in the middle of pain. Where is God in disaster? And I thought that was really kind of the theme of the album, was with all the pain in the world, there could be no God. And that's what his rather dark musings are, Ian Anderson's musings are on that album. But you know what? I'll go back and I'll give it another shot, Peter, since you brought it up. And it's been a while since I've listened to it all the way through. So I'll put that on my list of things to do before summer runs out and I got to start working for a living. Let me go to Todd in Seattle, Wildcard Line on Coast to Coast AM. Hey,
Thank
Todd.
Thank you, Mr. Pundit. I would like to ask you if you have ever listened to the Queensryche album called Rage for Order, where Chris DeGarmo wrote songs like I Will Remember, which were about a satellite age, and the second Queensryche album called The Warning, which prophesied the New World Order and space age domination.
Well, I like Queensryche a lot. We played a lot of the cut that sounds like Pink Floyd, the Silent Lucidity tune, which I thought was a great, great song. But I don't know that I'm that familiar with some of those other cuts you mentioned. I wonder whether Jason would be. It's a little like his book really does focus right up to 1980. But metal, you know, Queensryche is a lot of these metal guys are a lot more into sci-fi than I realized.
Yes, well, Chris DeGarmo was a genius science fiction writer, and he wrote every single song off of the early albums, which Jeff Tate is touring on now. And Chris was prophesied the New World Order on every album he wrote for them.
Oh, that's very cool. Well, I appreciate that. I think that's really neat. I'm glad to hear that kind of collaboration. Let me get to Sarah in Texas on Coast to Coast AM, open lines east of the Rockies. Sarah?
Hey, good evening. Thank you very much for the topic this evening. It's a lot of fun. And if you don't mind, kudos to the screen caller. He was a very nice gentleman. So there
Bobo.
Is that.
Bobo.
And, oh, right on.
That's his name, Bobo.
Well, thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you for taking my call. And I wanted to share that this is not an album, but I'm an Elton John fan for decades. And sure. I don't have every album, but I've got, like, I don't know, 36 or something like
wow.
that. Wow. I know, dude. I just wow. really love them. Oh, P.S., I'm Texas by way of California. I just moved out to Texas. So
okay.
Missing the ocean. So
I think I have every Elton John album up to Blue Moves.
Oh, right on.
I'm yeah, pretty sure I don't have anything after Blue Moves. I don't know why. Or maybe I had the soundtrack to The Lion King when my kids were born.
I had that. Aida or Aida. I can't remember how to pronounce it.
It's Aida. He rewrote the opera. Aida.
Thank you. Now I can look at it unopened still.
Oh, yeah.
You know, for my collection.
It's great. Aida's were great.
Thank you for that. Okay, so in 1974, Ian, they did him and Bernie in the band did Caribou. The album Caribou.
Sure.
Which you must have, of course.
I have it. Sure.
All right. Now, there's a song on there, and it's really awesome, and it's called I've Seen the Saucers.
Yeah.
And from time to time, you know, I'd bust it out and get in my, you know, EJ groove whenever it
sure.
hits me, and I just play that thing, and I'll hold the, you know, the folder, if you will, inside the where the lyrics are on, and I'll just read it over and over, and then I'll crank it and read it over and play it over, you know, so it just plays on repeat. So so there was that and, you know.
And the Rocket Man, too. Let's not forget Rocket Man.
Only Rocket Man. Absolutely.
Which is interesting because Jason wrote about it in Strange Stars. He was talking about how the song Rocket Man from Elton John, which I think we have coming up as a bumper later, really, it sort of copies Space Oddity. And I don't think Bernie Taupin like denies that connection, like the little topical connection to the major Tom saga. But it actually, Rocket Man goes back to another book that Bernie Taupin was reading. And so it's really, I mean, as a fan of that period quite a bit, I hadn't heard that story quite, and that's interesting. So we'll play Rocket Man coming up, and maybe as close as we get to Caribou or Rock of the Westies or any of those other mid-70s Elton John albums. But thank you for the memories. Those are fun. All right, let me go to first-time caller line. Nancy is in Victoria, Texas. It's open lines on Coast to Coast. Nancy?
Hi.
Hi.
I would like to talk about, like, a quick story about my crazy story of Hurricane Harvey, because it's the 1 year anniversary.
Oh, and you're thinking about the people. Thinking about the people in Hawaii.
Yes, because it's like mimicking of how I went through.
Yeah. Yeah. What about it? What was? Did obviously you survived, but I mean, how hard was it for you?
Within the first 2-3 days when Harvey was coming towards us, well, I had to, like, stay at a hotel just to, like, be precautions, because I live in a mobile home, and they told us, you know, just get out. Get out as much as you can. Get out as fast as you can.
Yeah.
And when when Harvey was coming, I was, like, checking on the wind speed, and it was going about 75 to almost 90 miles an hour when on impact.
It's amazing. How did the mobile home do?
It turned out fine. The problem was that we didn't have electricity for a few days, but days they got it fixed.
Would that get a little steamy inside the mobile home if you didn't have electricity for the air conditioning?
Right.
Yeah, I can't imagine what that'd be like. Glad you survived it. Thank you for sharing that, and that just will pass that along again for people to offer a prayer tonight before they go to bed, holding their thoughts. Look them up first thing in the morning. Just be mindful about what people in Hawaii are going through tonight while they're listening to Coast. Thank you, Nancy. We'll go Paul west of the Rockies in L.A. on Coast to Coast AM. Paul?
Hi, Mr. Punnett. I will try to be brief. I'm not here to sing your praises at all, sir, and I have a hard time calling you sir. I'm calling you, and I challenge you on air.
Why are we doing this?
Well,
why are we doing this? I tell you what, I'm gonna put you on hold. If you're calling up to pick a fight or something, man, just email me. Go through Twitter or go through LinkedIn, and we can have a conversation if you want. But I don't think we need to get into. If you're mad at me about something that you want to not. Okay, well then this isn't the right forum for that. But I hope you understand. I just don't feel like this is appropriate. If you can't even call me sir or be nice to me, let's not go there, okay? But there's lots of ways to get in touch, and I hope you do. Let me go, because I'd be happy to have the conversation with you. Just this isn't it. Patrick's on a wild card line in Miami on Coast to Coast. Patrick?
Hey, Ian, how are you?
Good. What's going on?
It's very interesting. I bounded in one night to Printer's Row, and who sat next to me but Kurt Vonnegut. And I said, Kurt, why are you here? He goes, I'm here because of author's rights. You know, I did not know that authors will sell all the rights to their stories for money.
Sure, yeah.
And he tells me this, and I go, did you know that David Bowie just sold 25 of his songs for $50 million up front?
Wow.
And he goes, what do you mean? I said, and it's the same genre, right? You know, sci-fi music. And Kurt looked at me. He goes, this is really important. And it was very interesting, because what I realized is that the musicians and the authors could work together so they can get paid and continue in their endeavor of art without selling, because they will, you know, all artists will sell their soul. But they, you know, they need to live. And David Bowie is very interesting, because I structured the deal. You know, he got $50 million, but he sold 20 of his songs. But at the same time, though, that helped Vonnegut and Bradbury to be able to retain just a little bit of their rights, so they can continue to, you know, not anymore, but for other authors, you know, to continue on in their endeavor. I thought that was very interesting in terms of the music and the writing working together.
Interesting. Yeah. You know, and that didn't used to be, by the way, those kind of numbers. That was never true for a long time for artists who would sell the rights to their material, be they books, articles, for next to nothing. And it's kind of tragic when you look back at, and there was a lot of vultures in publishing that kind of knew this, and they would come to an artist who just had a hit song and say, hey, I'll give you, I mean, it'll cost me, but I'll give you $5,000 for the rights to that song, knowing full well that the tune was going to be worth, you know, hundreds of thousands, if not millions of dollars, even pretty soon. And the same thing true with writers who sign away their rights because, you know, they got kids like anybody else, and suddenly somebody's offering money for a movie or something, and they sell the rights for next to nothing. Yeah, interesting story. I appreciate you passing that along. How sci-fi artists retain rights to get paid. Good question, especially because sci-fi didn't get the respect that it deserved for a long time, so they didn't get the best agents either. I know that from our friend Charles Pellegrino, who comes on all the time on Coast to Coast. And Charlie was telling me about how, really kind of how ripped off a lot of early sci-fi writers were, signing away something just because they were so grateful that anybody wanted to publish their stories. They just didn't really have a perspective on what those stories were worth. Go to Cody in Webster City, Iowa, on Coast to Coast. Cody?
Hi, I'm a first-time caller, long-time listener. And
good to have you.
Ian, I want to say you're doing an incredible job going in for George Norrie.
Oh, thanks.
I just wanted to bring up the point of how the 1968 songs that in the year 2525 kind of helped push sci-fi and rock and roll hand in hand to each other. What do you say about that?
Yeah, you mean the year 2525, that gets a lot of play. I have to say I have sort of a new respect for 2525, especially because it was an original creation. It wasn't based on anything. And it was just these two folk singers, I think they're from like Nebraska or something, and they wrote that song, which now that I look back on it, not having heard it already 1,000 times in my life, but to look back on it and hear it again, I have to say that was actually a very progressive thing that they were saying in song, because it kind of is a legit sci-fi narrative, beginning, middle, and end, in a song that's, what, 3 minutes long?
It goes from 2525 on from up to, like,
95-95.
Then it turns right around at 2525 again.
Yeah. Yeah, I think it's pretty cool, actually. So I'll play that as a bumper coming up, and you can regale in it as we do that, as we give the numbers out on the way. Let me get to Justin in Arkansas on a wild card line on Coast to Coast. Hey, Justin.
Hey, sir.
Hey.
Hey, I wanted to mention about Pink Floyd and Dark Side of the Moon and The Wizard of Oz, but first, yeah. I'm sure you've had many people mention Meniere's disease as far as the ear problem.
Meniere's, it's that's slightly different than the tinnitus I have. I know some people who have that, they sort of overlap with each other, but that's not what I have. But it is, it's hard. But so yeah, you're talking about the whole if we coordinate the beginning of Wizard of Oz and Dark Side of the Moon, how they kind of parallel each other if we play the music up?
Yes, sir. It is trippy as can be.
Isn't it?
And it's true. Like, and then just what you said earlier makes me think that there might be some credence to that. And further, Ian, if you start the final part of Dark of 2001 Space Odyssey, when it says Jupiter and the Infinite Beyond, and you turn over the backside of Echoes, which is a 25-minute song, or 28-minute song, Echoes, and the third part of 2001 Space Odyssey, it is crazy how it syncs up. Every song transition is a scene transition. And
oh, that's cool.
The finale, everything. It's awesome.
Yeah, well, I like that. I think there's a I was working for a radio station in Nashville, 103 KDF, and we did the thing live where we got the rights to do Wizard of Oz, show it on a big screen, and play Pink Floyd's music at the same time. And that was cool. It was a magical night. You know, the stars were out and everybody was tripping on it. So they may have had extra herbal help on the tripping. I know I didn't, but I think there was a lot of that going around the crowd that night. But yeah, there were a lot of oohs and ahs on that, and it is a fun thing to do if you've never done it before. Todd is in. Oh no, wait, I already did Todd. So what do we got? Okay, let's go to Richard. I think we're going to run out of time for everybody. So hang on, Richard wants to disagree on Jethro Tull, and Sean wants to talk about satanic music. And we'll get to that coming up. We'll give you all the numbers you need to join in the conversation. And I hope you do. Also, if you want to follow me on Twitter, you want to yell at me, tell me how terrible a human being I am. I may not agree with you, but everybody's entitled to their opinion. You can find me at Deacon Punnett on Twitter. And better way to have a conversation than live on the air. On Coast to Coast AM, this is Ian Punnett. Big show coming up tomorrow night. Good luck, George Norrie. Another one of those live shows. And there's one he's doing coming up in Phoenix. If you are so inclined, you can find out more, too, on the website about that show. It's an Afterlife Symposium. I will be there, I think. I'm just coming in just to say hi. Or maybe we're going out afterward. I can't remember. But I'll be seeing him anyway in a couple of weeks. In the meantime, in for George Norrie tonight, this is Ian Punnett on Coast to Coast. All right, so where do we start? Let's start with Dennis, west of the Rockies in Tacoma. I think he's been hanging on the longest on Coast to Coast AM. Dennis?
Yes.
Hey. Where do you want to take us?
Where I want to take it is the story of Badfinger. Very few people have ever heard of the band Badfinger. It was actually a group of four, which started as the Ivies in 1961 in Swansea, South Wales.
Why do you think people don't know about them? They were huge here in the United States.
Well, let me tell you the story. It's one of the most tragic stories in all of rock and roll, and possibly even in music. Two of the members. Okay, can I just play one or two clips?
No. Let me explain how this works. So, like, this is a thing where, like, this is not like you jump in the car and grab the wheel and you push me out on the road and take off. So I respect that. But, again, I mean, I know Badfinger. Actually, I was just talking about Badfinger about a month ago because of the tragedy of the suicides. And we were talking about that the night of, I can't remember who was it that had committed suicide. I think it was Anthony Bourdain. Yeah, and we were talking about it that night and how, you know, how tragic it was that really two great creative influences on a band which was as close to the Beatles in a lot of ways as other bands could ever be, having shared the same roof and the same label and the same producer, really, in Paul McCartney, that they came to such an early end. But was there more you wanted to say about Badfinger? Because, I mean, I think they're a great band. Yeah. I don't think anybody would dispute that.
Just a little bit of their history. They were supposed to be, they would have been the next Beatles. What happened was, you know, when Beatles formed the Apple label, they had the plan of developing musical groups throughout the UK, especially. And John Lennon specifically actually picked the name Badfinger. And he, Pete Ham was the lead singer.
Yes.
And some of their songs have been huge hits recorded by most of the great artists, Mariah Carey, you name it, all over the world. And yet, very little. You know a lot, Ian, about them. But it's funny. I don't think if you go out there into the average America, nobody would even recognize it. But they would immediately recognize their songs because they were actually huge mega hits.
Great hits. In fact, thank you so much. I appreciate that. Including Without You, which is a song that people don't associate with Badfinger, but of course the bigger hit from Nielsen. And I think you mentioned to Mariah Carey, but yeah, great songwriters. Still just so sad that there's so many rock stars that commit suicide. It's the dark side of that creative piece. I'll never figure it out. Wildcard line, Teresa is in Boulder on Coast to Coast AM. It's open lines. Teresa?
Hi, Ian. Glad you're there.
Thank
I always
you.
Liked you as a man of God on a popular radio station.
Dang straight.
Anyway, I want to know why the B-52s weren't mentioned in your show tonight.
Well, remember, they don't really come on until the 80s. So the B-52s, great band, but the book was mostly focused on the artists from 1969 to 1980. And then, so, you know, later on, obviously, they break out of Georgia, out of the bar scene, and become sensations. But what was it about that you wanted to mention in particular about B-52s?
Well, they have one album, and forgive me, I can't remember what it is. I'm 70 now.
I go through that all the time, and I'm not even close to 70.
Okay. You know, and I don't have inclination to go through all my stuff. But they had one song, I think it was Sugar Shack, that made it, that was popular.
Love Shack. Love Shack.
Love Shack, yeah.
Right. Okay, Sugar Shack was a song by a guy named Jimmy something and the Fireballs. But, in terms of space thing, like, they're cool. One of their coolest songs, I mean, Rock Lobster, obviously, but one of their other songs was Planet Claire, which is that it sounds almost like a piece from the soundtrack to a 50s sci-fi movie, which is actually they stole it. They stole the riff from Henry Mancini from the Peter Gunn theme. But it's just dun, 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 and it's Planet Claire. That's a great song. I love them. So there you go. We have appropriately feted them. Same thing. We could have mentioned more, too, from the 70s about Parliament Funkadelic, which Jason Heller had mentioned more in the book than I got to it on the air, but there's another great band, Bootsy as well, Bootsy Collins. Let's go to Gary, who's in Billings, Montana on Coast to Coast. Is that right, Gary?
That's correct.
All right. Where do you want to take us?
Oh, I just wanted to put in an honorable mention for Captain Beyond.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
They spawned, they had artists that went on to a lot of other big names in the 70s and beyond.
Right.
But, the songs like Distant Sun and Star Glow Energy and just the cover of the first album had a space dude floating in space with a little sphere of light in his hand. And, it was just a very, very cool band from the 70s that I really dug.
And there's another band, too, for, kind of in that same era, is a band called Hawkwind. Right? Bowie had been working with them. So it wouldn't surprise me. I read about 70% of this book, Strange Stars. I went and looked, a couple other people have mentioned a couple of people that I hadn't looked up yet in the book, and they're there. So I wouldn't be surprised if I went back to the gloss or back to the index, I would have found Captain Beyond. But thanks for that memory, Gary. I remember the name well. Let's go to Richard, who's in Connecticut on Coast to Coast AM. Richard?
Hi.
Hey.
Yes, I was surprised by your take on the album Aqualung.
It's been a while since I've sat down with it, but what's your take on it?
I believe my take is really based on an interview I heard with Ian Anderson, and he's actually very pro-religion. What it was his condemnation of society in general using God for their own devices. In other words, so we created God in our own image. The way it works sometimes. And, it's just like every country, God is on their side in a war.
Sure.
And things like that. And he said it. God isn't so much about rules as, it is about love. And we all know what's right. We don't always do it, but basically we all know what is right. And that really was it. There was a big thing, too, at one point. He got into an argument on TV in Britain with the head of the Anglican Church or something about the album. And he said, the guy was, a lot more, you weren't being negative. It was just your opinion was slightly different than I thought it would be. But, he was just saying, it's an outright insult to religion in general. And he said, in a sense, it was to organized religion.
Yeah, I think that's really my point, is that he was talking about theodicy is a discussion about where is God in crisis. And that there's in the song Aqualung, I could have sworn there's a bunch of references to the Salvation Army and the fact that this guy, this homeless guy, is kind of abandoned and they're not taking care of him. And that he's on the fringes of society. He may even have very disturbed schizophrenic thoughts. But there's other references like Cross-Eyed Mary and other stuff about these people that are sort of, shunted aside and then nobody's caring for them. But that's just, like I said, it's been a while since I've sat down and listened to the album beginning to end. But I sure do love Jethro Tull, and I appreciate your take on that. Let me go to Rick in California on Coast to Coast. It is open lines. We don't have to keep talking about music. I'm on board, but we can go anywhere you want. Go ahead, Rick.
Hi, Ian. This is a great subject. I'm really enjoying this show tonight.
Good.
I was just a couple of bands. I was really trying to get through when Mr. Heller was on, but maybe you might know some. A couple of bands of my favorites from the 70s are Electric Light Orchestra and Boston. Both
right.
Have science fiction themes with the spaceships. And ELO had their spaceship that during their tour that lifts up off the stage and so on.
Right.
Have any comment about that?
Yeah, the Out of the Blue tour, I think it was, the double album tour. I'm big on ELO. I think Jeff Lynne's production is great. I I don't, you know, I think here's an interesting distinction that the author makes, and I think this is one, if we can think critically for a second, I think a lot of people play off images because they're cool sort of cinematic images, like the spaceships of the Boston covers or the spaceships of Electric Light Orchestra. And there are a couple of songs I actually played in the first hour. I played From the Sun to the World, that instrumental at the bottom of the first hour. So there's a little bit from Electric Light Orchestra, but I think part of what he's really getting at is science fiction, where it isn't just like a reference to movie tropes or something like that. It, you know, because then we could bring up Goodnight Vienna from Ringo Starr, right? I mean, but I think it's really much more getting into a real scientific fiction narrative and talking about these issues of science in space in particular, and using those as a basis of song. Otherwise, I'm great with what you mentioned, and I think it's very interesting. And I think this is something which he and I disagreed on this, Jason Heller and I did in the first hour. I would never call Star Wars science fiction. I don't think there's any science in it. It's fiction, it's a space opera, and I love it, but it might as well be a Western. And, you know, that's about it. But I mean, it's not science-y, not in the way that other things are. Anyway, all right, Cora is in Taos, New Mexico, on Coast to Coast. Cora?
Yes, this is just more trivia. It's not musical, but sure. Somebody mentioned Kurt Vonnegut earlier.
Yeah.
And in some of his books, he had a character called Kilgore Trout, who was a science fiction writer.
Yeah.
And who wasn't well read or respected because the covers of his books and magazines were very lurid with, you know, half clad women and everything. So, you know, Kurt Vonnegut was kind of pointing to the fact that science fiction writers really did not get any respect.
Yeah. So, and that they're a bunch of lonely guys. You know, like there's a lot of that. It's kind of funny you mention that because it was the same sort of thing with true crime. Something with which I'm more familiar in the cover art, and the covers were really designed, these very lurid covers, but inside the writing was not very lurid at all. But they definitely played up the to attract the eye of the buyer. Excellent point on those covers. Thanks for that. Russell's in Georgia on Coast to Coast, open lines. Russell.
Hey, man.
Hey.
Look here, y'all can't leave Jimi Hendrix out.
We did talk about Jimi Hendrix.
Oh, you didn't? Oh, yeah. I must have been asleep.
Well, so here's what we talked about. You'll love this, though. If you didn't know this, the song Purple Haze was an expression that he took from a novel that he had been reading about a planet that had a purplish haze around it. And he was a huge, obviously, big sci-fi reader, as you know, but that's where that came from, and I never knew that.
And Up from the Skies on the first album about the flying saucers.
Right. And same thing with John Lennon. Like a lot of other people did, like, you know, a lot of stuff about science, about the flying saucers. It's weird because we don't even use the word saucer anymore like we used to, right? I mean, right. You know, saucers become such a, it's anachronism. People don't use it very often, but you go back in the 70s and saucers in music came up all the time. And it just seems kind of quaint now, I think. But
yeah.
Yeah, very good. Thank you, Russell. Appreciate that. All right, let's go to Lynn in Orange, California, on Coast to Coast. It's open line, so you can go anywhere you want, Lynn. Where do you want to do?
I'm curious to know why nowhere in media, in any format, I've heard no one talking about the fact that as of July 18th, the largest bank in the United States of America, Citibank, no longer takes cash payment, and you're limited in a calendar year to only put $3,000 in through their ATMs. Why have we not heard anything?
Really?
So
tell me how this works. So wait. So if you had $3,000 and somebody paid you because you moved a bunch of trees on their property, and suddenly, oh, here's your $3,000, and you go to put it in your ATM, you can't?
You can only put $3,000 for the whole year.
Okay. And then what happens if you try to put in more?
You don't get to because you've reached your limit.
Will the machine not open, I guess is what I'm getting at? It'll just tell you.
That's exactly. You hit
really?
The basket.
Wow.
It actually does a countdown on how much cash you put into it and when the bell will go off and you will no longer be permitted for the calendar year to put in any more cash. And you're not allowed to walk into the building and hand to the employees cash anymore.
Okay, shut up. So you can't at a bank, you can't, and this is just in California?
You hit it. You're the first one with the correct reaction. It's enormous. It's the largest bank in America.
Yeah. Well, and, you know, I actually don't, you know, truth be told, I have a severe allergy against big banks. Long before the scandal with the big banks, too big to fail thing, I don't prefer that. I always go with neighborhood banks or at most like a regional chain. And I've just never heard that. So that's why I'm out of the loop, because I wouldn't use Citibank anyway. But holy smokes, that's weird. And I wonder what that's, do you think it has anything to do with drugs? Like,
well, I know in the past,
money laundering?
Citibank did have a problem with that about 2 years ago. But that that has to do with the actual bank dealing with drug lords in Mexico, not the common everyday person. And that still doesn't explain. It's a bank. Cash goes into a bank and cash comes out of a bank. And they're saying they're not. How are they going to even replenish their cash? I mean, if you even look from the most simplistic point, and why would the common person be penalized? Why would the actual bank teller not be trusted with cash anymore? How are robbers going to rob the bank anymore?
I'm waiting for the people over at Serta Perfect Sleeper to tell me I can't put more than $3,000 under my mattress, that they're going to have special mattresses that they won't allow you to put. Lynn, that's very interesting. I will look into that, because that could be a whole show. It's the first I've heard of it. So you're good. Your question is well taken. Why is nobody reporting on it? I couldn't give you an answer for that. My suspicion is that if you look it up, you'll probably find that some people have. But I don't know. I'll get into that after I get off the air, because we've got too many other things to get to between now and then. Let me get to it. So it's coming up before the top. I think I'll get one call in from Richard. No, I can't. It's sorry. Hey, Richard, hang on. We'll be first, though. Richard from Victoria, B.C. And then we still have a couple open lines for you, too. We'll run the numbers after the top of the hour. And listen, again, watching The Wire for the latest on what's going on in Hawaii. If you have friends, you should check on them. And take a look at some of those cams that they've set up. The storms, the rain, it's dark. But it's going to be a wild night. We'll know more in the morning. Keep them not far from your thoughts. On Coast to Coast AM, this is Ian Punnett.